This is improvised radio theatre with dice, with me, Michael Kuehl,
and me, Roger Bell West.
And this month, the mists and fogs of autumn have moved into my lungs, and up my nose, and have coated my voice in a manner you may find distinctive to the season. I will try not to cough too much, and Roger is fortunate as he's not in the same room with me and cannot be infected.
But I can edit out any coughs that do make it through.
Oh, that would be a mercy, I think. This month we are going to be talking about... What are we talking about?
Well, with something that we've mentioned briefly of background and the eternal question of how much background should you generate and when.
And we'll also be talking about advice to young, innocent, inexperienced GMs and whether we should give it at all.
But particularly if for the sort of person who's starting up a game in isolation, as we did back in the day.
Because there was nothing but isolation back in those days.
But before we move on, I would just like to say thank you to John Hagen, who dropped some money in our tip jar.
Thank you, and thank all your comrades in donating to the tip jar and keeping our heads above water. Though mine is going glug glug at this moment.
Onward! Before we go on to any of that, I'd like to talk about a late-breaking bundle of holding from our friends at Cthulhu Reborn. We've talked about the Cthulhu Eternal system before, and I interviewed Dean back in March of 2022, so I think it's fair to say we're in favour of it. What you get here is several of the free system references for different areas that collectively make up the Cthulhu Eternal system. It's a good start. They're still free elsewhere. But what you also get is H.P. Lovecraft's Book of Yog-Sothoth Othery, and the Open Cthulhu Mythos SRD from the German Lovecraft Society, though translated to English, both of which add flavour to the core rules by listing various creatures, cults, tomes and so on, which are explicitly derived from Lovecraft's own work, so you can safely use them in anything you ought to publish without having to worry about somebody else claiming a licence violation. My own feeling is that you should do as Lovecraft did and invent a new monster for each story rather than worry about the stats for the same old, but that's up to you. The bundle also has 8 short adventures, plus 7 more if you go full price, and it's open until the 17th of November.
This is something I've been thinking about recently, when I examined my own processes in generating game settings, and in especially in reaction to other people's game settings, which I have foolishly fallen in love with and have an enthusiasm for. It never lasts. They always leave me. But
except RuneQuest.
Except RuneQuest. All right, RuneQuest is slightly different and is somebody else's enormous background. The thing I was going to say was, I have recently said that you should only create detailed accounts of any game element when you need to specify them and make them real and fit them into the background of the game and get them ready to meet the players. I was speaking specifically about villains and how they can be left mysterious and ooky for a while, and their motivations and their capabilities can be put together in response to what the players think about them at the rumor stage. And that's all well and good, but it occurs to me this is something I sometimes break away from when it comes to the matter of deep background, deep explanations why the world is the way it is. Now, you'll have seen, especially if you look at something like Harn, that fantasy settings especially have an account of the ages before an account of the way history was, at least in outline,
which,
when they're
which
first
is
put
not,
forward.
Yeah, which is not only something that standard new player who's playing a fantasy game probably doesn't immediately need, it may well be a thing that their character doesn't know.
It really should be a thing that their character... Unless their character says scholar and historian, then they shouldn't have more than a vague idea what's going on. You might estimate it would be very interesting to travel back in time and speak to ordinary people and ask them what they knew about the past history of their country, of their world, at various points in history. And I'm sure you get a very different account from English medieval peasants, from English 17th, 18th century peasants, to industrial workers, to the 20th century.
Well, for a start, there is a vast difference in worldview, because the medieval peasant thinks life has always been basically like this and it probably always will be.
Quite. I mean, the imagination of things being different. But the point I was going to come to was, it's not only very peculiar, it's also very Tolkien-esque. Because I think that this comes from what Tolkien did, and what Tolkien did very, very successfully, is tie everything in Middle Earth into the deep history of Middle Earth. That the shadow of the past in various ways lies over the whole work. Now, it's not just the explanation at the start, it's also where all those creatures and monsters and ghosts and things come from. They come from the deep layered past that he produced. And it works so well for him that people have assumed that you sort of have to do this.
Also, I think there is a parallel here. For advice that used to be given to fantasy and science fiction authors, it may still be. I don't hang around in those circles as much as I used to. But let us say, for whatever reason, you need to know some crunchy details about the world.
Yeah.
How magic works, how the spaceship works, whatever. That should not be in the book. Unless there is an actual reason for the characters to talk about it.
It shouldn't be in the book.
It should be in your background notes. If you're Tolkien, you can put this in an appendix. If you're Catherine Kurtz, you can put it in the notes sides of Dirinni Magic, the anthology of short stories and notes on how the magic works.
Yeah.
Mostly you don't. And I think this is a principle that needs to be applied in games as well. It's tricky because what you do when you look at Harn, what I do when I look at Glorantha background or whatever else, we see the thing that is addressed to the GM, and that gives the detail because the GM potentially needs to know it. There is not a big sign saying only you need to know this. You could leak it out in a game if it's important.
Yeah, what I'm starting to question in my current thoughts on the matter is how much the GM needs to know, and whether I have been fussy, overly fussy in the past about wanting to know, wanting things to make sense at my level. I mean, it's a lot easier if it does make sense, but I'm wondering if I am committing an offence sometimes by going and writing in the background. Is there always, for most GMs, a moment when you say, hang on, that doesn't make sense? Is there, I'm not sure there's a background the only one I can think of that's done the Tolkien deep background successfully is Professor Barker, and most of that is most of Tecumel is wrapped up in his love of linguistics and stealing cultural bits from Mesoamerican culture. But his work for me, I don't feel there is something wrong here. I do feel there's something more to be said. There's some issues he hasn't addressed, but I don't feel there's something wrong. I find it most satisfactory when I can say to myself, aha, I know how that's going to work in my iteration of this universe, and I can tweak it to favour the things that I find interesting. But I'm not sure I need to do that, and I'm not sure I'm not flooding my players with stuff they don't need to know.
Well, that I think to some extent that depends on the game, and I'm going to try to avoid loaded terms here because obviously I have a preference, but I don't want to suggest that my preference should be the one that prevails for everybody. Broadly, are you writing genre fantasy or distinctive fantasy or SF or whatever else?
What is? Hang on.
Genre fantasy is the standard fantasy.
Uh huh.
It's the thing you expect when you pick up a book that says fantasy on the spine. It's got elves, it's got orcs, or it's got renamed orcs if they're scared of the Tolkien lawyers. It's got the party. It's the Tough Guide to Fantasyland, basically. Which, anybody who hasn't read the Tough Guide to Fantasyland, you need to read this book. But anyway, that's a separate thing. The point is, if you don't specify how the world was made, how the gods work, whatever else, people are going to pastiche that in from their assumptions of genre fantasy or whatever else.
Yes.
And it's going to be the standard way these things happen, which may be fine. If it's not a thing that's important in their game, it doesn't matter. But consider Bujold's World of the Five Gods, which, as I think we have said before, to my mind is the closest I have read to a book that covers the way actual medieval Christians thought of God, being involved in their lives at all times. Every decision you make has that flavour of, and how will this affect my relationship with God? Even in cultures that don't have a personal relationship with God, there's how, is this going to put more years in purgatory or something? If you tried to do a game in that world without talking in detail about how the gods work, you would not have a game that captured the important things of that world.
What was the term you used? Distinctive fantasy. Can you say what you mean by that?
Yeah, fantasy that is not the standard thing. So again, using the World of the Five Gods as an example, you're not going to get generic priests who heal in that world. You are going to get healers, some of whom may also be temple-trained divines, some of whom will work for this god, some of whom will work for that god, depending on what context you're needing the healing in. If it's a farming accident, then probably the person who will be immediately available is the divine who I think it's the father who basically looks after farmers. Because that's the temple that's most immediately to hand, and they have healers because everybody has some degree of healers. If you're out being a, or is it the soldier? Is it? I can't remember who's the farmers anyway. But whoever is that, and then if it's an accident, a battlefield medic that you need, then that will be a different order, quite possibly, and so on. So if you just said, oh well, there are gods, you would not get that feeling, and you would not get the feeling that I think is important to making that world specific. Yeah, what is the point of running a game in this world, not generic fantasy? And I would say the reason for running a game in the World of the Five Gods is the five gods. It's the sorcery, the demons, the shamanism.
Yeah, I know sometimes I wince when I get evidence that my players are in a generic fantasy and I am doing something I think is distinct and better. But on the other hand, I have been in games where somebody has run something from a published world that he's really enthusiastic about. And I think it was Eragon. And I had never read the books and I had no clue. And then I was the person who was just going on his generic adventurer tendencies. And a lot of adventures I have written are meet monster, meet mystery, meet political opponent, solve the encounter, go on to the next thing. And they could have taken place in plenty of worlds. I was throwing detail and flavor at it like nobody's business, but I may have been wasting my time.
One of the things that I personally very much appreciate about the adventures of yours that I have played in is the theology, which perhaps overlaps a bit with what I was saying about the world of the five gods, but it's... this is not just the modern approach of, well, you know, maybe there is a god over there and we pay lip service to him. It's, no, this matters. This matters potentially more than anything else in your life.
Yeah, well, I have... Yes, but that's me bringing my obsessions to the game.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Should you
be bringing the things that bore you to the game?
I don't know. I had quite distinct reactions to GURPS Banestorm, which made me say, "Oh yes, this is interesting." And what happened before all this? And who are these mysterious people in the background that Phil Masters is working so hard not to specify who they are? and what can I do with that? And on the other hand, I look at GURPS Infinite Worlds, and there are mysteries there in the background, but I can't get myself interested in them. I can't even work up the energy to speculate about what really might have gone on and why the powers that be in the setting are the powers that they are. It doesn't excite me. It doesn't make sense to me.
Whereas John Dolman did... Okay, he had to do some fairly major surgery on the Infinite Worlds background.
Yeah.
But we had an extended campaign in that. We were Kabbalists.
Yeah, which are the weird ones amongst the major factions.
We were quite weird, even by the standards of the Kabbalists, because we were using a style of magic developed by Isaac Newton.
He gets the blame for everything.
And Isaac Newton, obviously.
Yeah.
But in that, we did actually resolve some of the big questions. Not to mention the whole Infinity Centrum Cold War thing.
You resolved that?
Yes.
Well done.
But partly by saying, "Oh right, that's why you care about quantum. You haven't worked out the math properly."
Yeah, I think that may have been the basic problem I had with Infinite Worlds. It expressed its mysteries in terms of abstruse, high dimensional mathematics, and I knew that I didn't understand that sort of thing. All right, so
for example, there is a thing in the background. Before any of the Interworld Service or anything else actually gets started, a particular researcher talks to the high muckety-muck politicians and says something to them which is secret,
but
which scares them so much that they set up the Infinity Patrol.
And they let him run things and don't poke in too much. That's a terrifying thing.
And that was a thing that John obviously had to answer. What did he say? Because that would affect the whole future relationship between those organisations. I'm not going to say here what it was, but he had an answer for it, and it was one that I at least found plausible when we did eventually find it out.
Well, I'm glad for John, I'm glad for you, but that was the point at which I stuck with that setting. I thought, the what, the how, anything I say here is going to be ridiculous. Now, I think I just didn't care enough. So the question is, there is an actual question in this segment. The question is, how much of filling in the background is something you can leave to the last minute? How much do you have to respect the nonsense that you're given sometimes by publishers? and how much is any of this important? I don't know. I don't know
well,
how much...
I think we can answer all of those things.
All right, go ahead.
How much do you have to respect the nonsense depends on the publication scheme. If you're using something from SJ Games where, you know, the Infinite Worlds book is out, there is probably not going to be an Infinite Worlds Volume 2 until there's a GURPS Volume 5th edition, if that ever happens. The fundamental assumptions of the setting are not going to be changed. If they publish more Infinite World stuff, as they do occasionally, it's going to be, here is this specific world, or here are several specific worlds, and here are the adventures you can have in them. They are not going to be, here is the progress of the Infinity Centrum War. And therefore, you can answer the big questions yourself in whatever way you see fit, as long as it is consistent with the small stuff still more or less working.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a very good way of expressing it.
And it's similar to the thing I think I mentioned last time. I've certainly mentioned it in a few places, that the Firefly fan wiki, when I was running a Firefly game, every time this particular planet is mentioned, is written up on the page of that planet. If it's not there, there has never been a canonical answer, so I can say whatever the hell I want.
Yeah, you have to be careful with fanfic. Because, A, you will steal their ideas.
To clarify, this is the fan wiki, but it is writing up only official sources, official published
stuff.
All
right. Well, in that case, I will still make the point about fanfic. In a sense, you're doing fanfic for the official setting.
Absolutely.
In fact, every developed campaign, everything that isn't just take this series of adventures, publish for the game, and run them, and then stop. Everyone is going to be a fan fiction development of the basic setting, and as your world will vary, then you have to keep consistent with the things you've said and the things you've changed, and be very aware of those.
I regard consistency in the world as very important, because if things can just be inconsistent, then what does what we do matter?
Yes, you have to have the sense that your agency is working on a real world and not a flimsy fiction. It's the point at which the fans watching a TV series think, hang on, that's not what they said before. Hang on, that character's just disappeared. Hang on, none of this makes any sense. And that's the point you're trying to avoid at all times.
Yeah.
With your players and with your setup.
There's a thing I sometimes say, that every fictional world is necessarily contrived, because you are bending it to the shape you need to tell the story you want to tell in it. If you're writing linear fiction, or to run the game you want to run in it. But it should never feel contrived. Because when you see the stage flats as stage flats rather than the Forest of Arden, the suspension of disbelief is gone and it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
I lose the emotional investment.
Yeah, I feel the danger of letting my enthusiasm run away with me and making the game about the things I care about rather than the things the players will care about. And I feel probably I should allow the players to play and be people who are unconcerned about the deep meaning of their world. You should be able to play an unthinking British patriot in the 19th century, even if elements of the game are going into, well, the less pleasant aspects of being an imperial power. And you should be able to have consistent motivation and a lack of interest in what is really going on in that world. And I should still be able to give you a good time. That sounds indecent.
Only if you're doing it right.
Only if it's done right. But I want to be able to care, and sometimes... sometimes I should not care. Sometimes I feel I should just get on with providing the adventure and figuring out any complications at a later date, if there are complications.
Well, I think there may be a higher and lower level consideration here. Considering, for example, the dungeon bashes I played when I first started role playing, there was never any suggestion of a bigger campaign. You know, here is a dungeon. We will go down it. We will fight things in it. Some of us will die. Eventually we will finish this dungeon, and then we will go on to another dungeon. And, you know, even though various iterations of early D&D had the idea of you build a stronghold, you attract followers and stuff, that was not something that ever happened in the games that I played in, because we were quite happy with it's effectively the Lone Ranger. You know, he comes to the town, he fixes the problem in that town, he moves on. It is an eternal. Or Doc Savage, similarly. What Robin Laws would call the iconic heroes. That there is no progress. There doesn't need to be.
Mm.
These days, I am more inclined to say, well, I do actually want some progress in the characters or in the world or both.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that pushed me that way was a World War II game. Because, obviously you could, as was it Warlord Comics did for many years, you could have just, stories of the war.
Mm.
But I find it more interesting to say, yes, but the war is going to end one day. And how are you going to prepare for that? How are you going to react when it happens?
Not only that, but the nature of the war changes as the task changes, as the problem, the front to be faced this week, this month, this year.
If you weren't, as I was, doing it with potentially world-changing magic, well, actually world-changing magic, even if you said, this is the story of this particular infantry company going through the war, they're going to be doing different things. They're going to be not just fighting different enemies, but fighting in different terrain, fighting different sorts of fight. A house clearance is not the same thing as standing on guard somewhere.
I have dabbled my toes in a thing called Band of Blades, which is a Forged in the Dark game about a regiment that is falling back from a terrible defeat by the forces of the undead, falling back to the past where hopefully they'll be able to take a stand, and the nature of their problems. The system is designed, I didn't get to play it out very much, but the system is designed that the nature of their problems changes and the nature of their resources changes depending on the success of the things they get to do and the things they choose to do. Every session, the system generates two or perhaps three problems which somebody needs to fix.
Hmm.
And the one that they choose to give their attention to is likely to be the one that is solved best. But the others have to be resolved in the background by dice rolling and chance. And that's a very neat setup and is a design that I'm surprised hasn't been copied more. But it's a very bleak but comradely setting. You have great agency and great risk, and you'll probably play a lot of different soldiers as people die. And that's something I quite admire.
Does this have anything to say about the overall progress of the retreat? I mean, is there a track you can go up and when you get to the end of it, you say, right, we've got to safety, this campaign is over?
There are fail points. And if you do manage to get part of the unit all the way back to the castle at the pass, then what you manage to recover from and scrounge and get together on the way back is going to matter very much in the final climactic battles. But before you get to the battles, you can have failed.
Oh, sure.
And that's a very there is very little fudging in that, and I sort of regret the fact I didn't get to do more of it, but maybe it'll happen someday. All right, I think the question that remains for me is what is it that sparks the interest of a GM in the background of a setting that makes it worth your while to customize it and expand it and make it more important to the games that get played? And can our readers, listeners, why did I call them readers? Can our vast and influential audience talk to us about the things that they wanted to change, wanted to fix, thought they did terribly cleverly? Because I think it would be worth writing about that, about adapting the published worlds to your own needs. And not only the published worlds. I ran once a very odd Gertz-based 1950s science fiction-ish setting in which I threw everything in the kitchen sink at it, including the Illuminati and aliens and ghosts and telepaths. I think its high moment was the moment at which Winston Churchill became an immortal illuminate, because he insisted, that's why. And you know, rodent like aliens, and it was fun for me, but I can't help feeling that was one of the occasions on which I let my enthusiasms overwhelm what the players might have been interested in. So,
well, I would argue that the thing to watch for there is, you know, here is a problem. Everybody takes the problem terribly seriously, but here is something else that swoops in and casually disposes of it that nobody even knew existed. That is my problem generally with anything goes settings.
Yeah. Oh, well,
I would like to talk about Doctor Who.
Carry on.
Not that this is an obsession of mine or anything, but in particular, I'm thinking about the original series.
Yeah, go on.
Because they went to quite a lot of trouble. They didn't establish a background. As far as possible, they didn't. And there is some stuff in the very early stories that is hinting. But essentially, yeah, you are from somewhere else. Which might be an alien planet, might be the far future. I mean, it's not specified in enough detail that you can even really reliably tell between those. But you have this basic problem. It is theoretically the same program going on for 26 years. Well, or however many, I can't remember. Once something is in the background, it is in the background forever.
Yes.
And individual producers do not stamp hard on additions to the background.
No, well, they want a new monster. They want a thing that they put in and made memories for lots of people with, which is more than fair enough.
So all of a sudden, bam, we introduce the Time Lords.
Oh, hang on. The Time Lords... Yeah, the Time Lords are a problem because they are that powerful. And you'll notice that they have been crapped upon in New Who.
Hmm.
Because this is the difference.
But once the Time Lords are there, every time you do something, you have to consider, well, what is the Time Lord involvement in this, if any? And you know, then a few years later, I think it was Robert Holmes casually invents the planet Gallifrey. And so on. And there was nobody in a position to tell the successive script editors, no, you don't get to do that. And this is absolutely not a planned structure, which is why it's so wildly inconsistent in places. At the canonical three different versions of the sinking of Atlantis.
Yeah.
What you've effectually got is it's a whole bunch of separate writers, mostly presenting a finished script that hardly gets tweaked at all, usually. There's no show bible. This is what happens if you ad hoc things, and it can be quite fun. I enjoy classic Doctor Who.
But would you want to do it yourself? Yeah, the lots of different authors and not a great deal of central thematic control might also remind you of much role playing game publication.
Yeah, and players may well be the obsessive fans in this analogy.
Yeah,
because players are the ones who, in a game, will say, "Well, hang on a minute. Last time,
you said, yeah, I had a burst of that last night when I restarted a campaign which had been paused for a while and tried to wrap up the first big mystery of it. And Jenny, who keeps the notes, pointed out." That's not what I said the last time. And I'd been reading from my original, my first setup notes, and she had been reading from what I actually said, and it was embarrassing. And what is more, a red herring that I dropped in the first episode, and they never chased. They decided it was important now, and they crossed across the peninsula in order to dig up a body that would only have given them a minor clue in the first place. I couldn't come up with anything better. Oh dear, never mind. Timing is important.
But if we circle back to the original questions, I think the problem with saying I will generate this later is that it now cannot be fundamental to the world, which is often fine.
Ah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm certainly not saying you should generate everything because everything is fundamental to the world. That's not the case. There are things that can be just completely standard.
Split in, yeah.
But if it's going to be important, if it might be important, if you want the option of making it important, then you need to know the answer. And the thing I usually say about running a world is I want to know the big things because then I can make the little things that actually happen in the game consistent with them, even if the big things never get explicitly mentioned. And maybe even foreshadowing a bit.
Yes, but I think a light sketch of that is probably preferable to actually doing the hard work and digging down enough to be able to draw upon it at a later date. That said, I do have a whole unused background for the Watchers Council in Buffy the Vampire Slayer that I never got around to using. One good thing about generating a role-playing background is you're unlikely to get anybody else coming along afterwards and saying, hang on, why did you do it this way? They're all off doing their own thing.
And if that does happen, congratulations, your background is a huge success.
I think the difference between... It's interesting to note that the old Who regarded the Time Lords and and Gallifrey and all that backstory as something interesting to explore, whereas new Who writers regard it as a yoke around their neck and a burden.
Well,
you can
understand why,
but I do think they could have treated the Time Lords better than they did.
Well, part of that, I think, is because of experience from the latter years of the original show, when they had somebody who... Basically, a person in charge who didn't really care about all this stuff and kept trying to get a different job, and a person advising him who was an obsessive fan.
Yeah.
And so what they ended up producing was a whole lot of stories about little casual snippets of deep background that had been mentioned once in a story 20 years ago, which were frankly inaccessible to the casual viewer who was their core audience.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that they were trying to keep in mind with the new show was it's got to remain accessible to the casual viewer, and indeed they've drifted away from that in the latter years. By many accounts, I gave up watching it myself.
Well, I was the sort of person who would look at something and say, yeah, but you can't do that because of something you said in 1963. So maybe I am not the ideal person that anybody should ask. Probably I'm the person who would ill-advise the producer.
I mean, in the early years of the classic show, there was this recurrent theme of you absolutely cannot change history. Whether that's you really, really, really should not or you cannot was never specifically stated, but there was an implication of both. And then they noticed, well, hang on a minute, this kind of limits the stories we can tell.
Yeah, but... Yes, but now they have taken it so the climax of the Doctor Before Last was a cosmically involved chaotic mess that made absolutely no sense at all, just from the beginning of one episode to the end. And I think they may have exploited the freedom to alter things a little bit too much.
Of course, where time travel is involved, I will recommend people who haven't done it go and watch the film Primer until you feel you understand it.
Does this ever happen?
Yes.
Okay.
But I would argue that the core point that film is making is that time travel is not compatible with our brains that are wired to understand causality.
Probably, yeah.
Once it's out everywhere and everywhere. Right now. You do not have the reaction speed to deal with this. Electrons don't have the reaction speed to deal with this.
And yet my future self has consistently failed to turn up with the immortality potion and tomorrow's winning lottery numbers. The swine. Shall we move on to something else?
Yes.
Thank you.
We have talked before about how to introduce new players, particularly to an existing group or a long-running campaign. But what about new players who are getting this stuff going on their own?
Yeah.
How can we... Well, for a start, they probably aren't listening to us. But if we have friends who are in this situation...
We can offer our advice and pitch it into the unknown. What's it called? Bread upon the waters.
Particularly since when I got started, it was very often one person in a group at school or wherever has heard of this new thing.
Yeah.
And they will start running a game, and that will affect the local culture because the game that they get out of the books will not be the same as the game that anybody else gets out of the books.
Yeah. And the books are going to affect what sort of game they get out. Assuming that somebody out there, that one of them is turning to his aged uncle or whatever it is and saying, could you possibly show me how this sort of thing works and what would you recommend?
Well, probably then, not wanting his aged uncle to run the game for him because, my goodness, that would be embarrassing.
That would be really embarrassing. happened to me. I was very lucky. The thing I was going to say was there's a lot of choices to be made and the early choices are going to sort of fix into the mind because they tend to. So it's a very delicate decision about what you should recommend.
I've met people coming to the SJ Games forums, and presumably that's a tiny fraction of the people who consider playing GURPS, who have played typically D&D, and they have got these core assumptions that all role-playing games must be like D&D. And GURPS is more similar to D&D than most, but, oh boy, there's a lot out there you're missing.
Yeah, I don't think we can, by our massive intellect and will, do much to chip away at the dominance of D&D, but we can possibly show that there are alternatives. I would say there are two big alternatives, two big groupings, and one is the simulationist sort of game, of which, strangely, D&D is a subset. It's just simulating something very odd.
And I'd argue that that's gone back and forth. It started off being as we know as extensions to a war game, which could be regarded as simulationist. But by now, I think the world that is simulating is the world that the rules define.
And the world that generations of playing have made popular and have defined in and of themselves. There are various flavours, various districts of the great continent. But this has been created out of the playing, which is something we generally recommend.
But also there is this zeitgeist of what a fantasy game works like.
Yeah.
And this comes on to my first real point, which is a game that matches a setting that already interests you.
Yes, this came up when this was being discussed on RPG Yet, and there is... I'll try and dig out the URL and we can include it. There is a list of role-playing game genres on RPG Geek, and it's quite good. The games... Sometimes the categories are a little empty, but somebody's put a lot of work into saying... This type of fantasy. Fantasy Arthurian, fantasy Arabian, fantasy generic.
Yeah, so, I mean, if there is a specific literary world, or TV or film or whatever, one would have to say, don't necessarily get the official licensed game, though these days it may actually be quite good.
Yeah.
But there will probably be something that matches more or less that sort of thing.
The big categories I was going to divide things into were crunch, lots of detailed systems, and less crunchy, but dedicated to particular types of stories and adventures and ideas, rather than to getting the details right. I mean... anybody who likes to play GURPS isn't going to argue about getting the details right. But he's going to argue that that isn't important. But there are... I'm not sure I would recommend it to the average person, to the average teenager. But then again, maybe
I would say that the core problem of starting one's role-playing career with GURPS is the same as the core problem of learning GURPS, which is that you have to internalise the entire system before you can generate a character. I'm not saying in detail, but you need to know broadly, you're making a lot of choices.
Yeah.
As a GM, you're making a lot of choices because you're saying, these are the traits that I'm going to allow in my game and those are the traits that I'm not.
Which you're going to say in any game.
Yes, but you need to know what those traits do in order to say, no, that doesn't suit me, I'm going to disallow it, or I'm only going to allow it in this variation, or whatever. That's a problem.
We're assuming here that the way to learn this stuff is to watch somebody else do it.
Well, that's an option already, but there aren't a lot of examples of GURPS being played in this way. I was thinking also more of, I've heard about this role-playing thing.
Yeah.
What can I do at home? What can I go out and buy and then play with my friends, as opposed to joining an existing role-playing group? I would also... I'm going to take a thing that I found a bad experience, but I think can be a good one. That Blades in the Dark that you ran, I felt the system was trying to hold my hand and tell me, you could do this, or you could do that, or you could do that. As an experienced role player, I found this very frustrating because I am already thinking of the in-character of the things that my character could do. But if I were new to this and perhaps not entirely sure of what's possible, it's great to have those suggestions there. These are things not only that you can do, but the rules are there to cover you when you do them.
The rules should be there when you choose to do something the rules don't define.
Yes, but that is harder to write.
Yeah.
Similarly with Powered by the Apocalypse, which, again, I don't particularly enjoy playing myself. I have played it a few times. Because it squishes down the infinite variety of things you could do to a small number of moves. And if you are using the X move, then the mechanical resolution is basically going to be the same. And you're going to roll some dice and you're going to say, OK, I got a partial success.
Yeah,
but at least it does tell you the sort of thing that might mean. And if you do not find that frustrating, then this could be a great game.
I'll tell you, it gives you immense support for being able to say these are the sort of things that Dungeon Adventurers can are known to do.
Or post-apocalyptic survivors or whatever else, yeah.
Yeah. And this is the sort of thing that your particular type of post-apocalyptic survivor or dungeon delver or whatever it is especially good at doing. But there is a strong improvise it as you go quality about Powered by the Apocalypse and its several descendants that make me worry about giving it to a first-time GM. A first-time GM, I think, needs a fairly solid, fairly idiot-proof adventure to be able to get their feet off the ground and start developing the instincts to run any sort of adventure, any sort of game.
One thing that I would say works potentially quite well, I'm not a great fan of Call of Cthulhu 7th Edition because I think it is much more heavyweight and complicated than it needs to be. But given that caveat, I think they have a lot of good one-shot adventures. Not only in the core book, but in the various... there are at least two collections of three or four adventures each which are designed to be run in a single session. I have played and or run most of these at some point.
Yeah.
And I like that model for Call of Cthulhu. You can have a high casualty rate because horrific things are happening. because it is a one-off adventure, and you may even have pre-gens for that for the next what time you play. Once you've got the hang of that, and perhaps once you've started saying, yeah, okay, maybe we can be a bit cautious here and still find out what we need to find out to survive, then you can say, right, well, now let's consider a longer-running campaign. You know, you are the monster investigators. What are you going to do about this, that, or the other? And then you could say, right, well, here are your long-term characters rather than pre-gens. Pick the guy you actually want to be.
Hmm. I was thinking of Call of Cthulhu as being the best supported system. I'm not sure that. I think that the habits you would get by starting with Call of Cthulhu would be slightly better habits than you would get by starting with D&D. But I'm still not sure that it doesn't bend. It doesn't bend your mind into assuming that the world is always a certain shape. And things always go a certain way, and there's only that sort of story. I don't know. I think there is a game for newbies, is going to have a certain amount of system support, but isn't going to be as crunchy as Call of Cthulhu can be. I honestly don't quite know where the sweet point is in this. I know that people can have immense fun with almost anything. If they've got that initial burst of enthusiasm, they can learn a lot and they can do a lot. But ideally saying, read this, try that, is a horrible responsibility. I'm not quite sure what the best answer is.
My anti-capitalist tendency makes me want to say a relatively small and unsupported sort of game, because you can start playing with D&D and you may well have a good time, but everything you read about it will channel you into buying more D&D stuff.
Yes,
it's Call of Cthulhu does this a bit less, but it certainly encourages you to buy more Call of Cthulhu stuff. And so,
Well, there is the fact that Call of Cthulhu has changed less since its first edition than D&D has in one change of edition. And I think that makes it a bit pointless to try to charge people through their teeth for new material for Call of Cthulhu, because there's a lot of very cheaply available stuff.
Well, particularly since most of it is rules updated versions of old material. They don't seem to be, they don't have the commissioning editors to get the campaigns that people love and talk about 20 years later anymore. That was a small number of specific people at Old Chaosium. I'm not saying the new guy is bad because he isn't one of these few commissioning geniuses, but. That's what they've got at the moment, and they're aware of it, and they're putting out a whole lot of here is the old thing updated. Which, if you're me, but you still have the old thing, isn't all that useful.
Right, I got to say, comments about our troll pack will now mutter amongst our listeners who are fans of RuneQuest. I will say one thing I don't know exists might be. Maybe Seth Sikorski actually provides some of this. Is a GM looking at the way he handled various developments and how he looking at a recording of his actual role play sessions and saying, now this is the point at which I decided to do this and this is how I decided to handle that. I don't know if it would be useful, but it might be. I proposed this topic, and I'm feeling the burden of the responsibility. My first instinct was to go with Powered by the Apocalypse, because I have fun with it. I find it useful. I found it very easy to set up, but I'm horribly aware that there is a huge hurdle to be overcome. I might suggest that you take Monster of the Week, if that's a fantasy setting that that appeals to the young person and offer them that because it has the most realized adventure seeds of any of the Powered by the Apocalypse things and is less inclined to hand wave things towards whatever the players and the GM find agreeable. But it's still a huge leap away from the sort of detail you'd get in an early Call of Cthulhu adventure in which you're going to go out, find the monster and maybe get slaughtered.
Yeah, though I think to some extent we should perhaps say, you know, there may be children who don't make up stories. I don't think I've ever met one. Mm. And somebody who is used to that approach may well find a very light system that says, okay, you know, you say we do this, and here is how you find out whether you succeeded or not, rather than just saying, oh, well, obviously we succeeded. And that's where I think Powered by the Apocalypse has some advantage, because although its mechanical resolution is very low, it will at least give you an answer, and then you can go on from there. The cardinal piece of advice I would give, I think, is there are people who talk about fail forward, and they very rarely seem to know what they're talking about, but you will screw up.
Yeah.
Do not worry about it.
Do not attempt to go back.
But sometimes the screw-ups can be great fun anyway.
Yeah. So,
you are probably not Tolkien. If you are, well, that's great.
I have a list of games which I have found fun, but looking back on them, they're all games which I had a burst of enthusiasm for and then didn't use much again. Things like Buffy and what's it called? Not Fate Fun. Rhesus, that was the one I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
And they are simple. They are the simplest system. Rhesus is one of the simplest systems I know, and I've recommended that to beginners. But I know. I think maybe what you need is an apprenticeship.
Yes, but that's out of scope for this specific time thing we're talking about. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
If you can. Well, it depends. I mean, I have certainly met people who have been put off the idea of running games of their own because they have seen one of the big play recordings like Critical Role.
Yeah.
And they think, well, gosh, that's really impressive. But how can I do that at home? I don't have the props budget. I'm not a professional voice actor. They don't even know about the script coordinators when the editor's working behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I'm blowing my own trumpet here to some extent, but that is one of the things I really like about the Watson Hall style. One of the reasons, apart from there being a really lovely bunch of people, that I stick with them. Tell me if you hear this, you owe me a pint. But it is a recording of a bunch of friends getting together and playing a game.
Yes,
length. We are not putting on a dramatic performance.
No, quite.
It's and just, we're playing a game and there's a microphone in the room.
Yeah, I've resisted doing this with my regular groups on the grounds that we are all too friendly and too honest with each other.
Hey.
And I'm not entirely sure how they would go if I told them, I'm going to broadcast this later. But anyway...
Oh, sorry, that's basic. Absolutely consent before you even do the thing.
Yeah. Well, yes,
consent but, before recording, never mind anything else.
I would not spring it on them, but I would fear how it would affect their play.
Yeah.
Anyway, have we come to a useful conclusion?
Well, there is just one other thing I'd like to say. This is a bit of D&D bashing, but again, it's a thing I've met on the SJ Games forums when people come to D&D, which is that E.T., arguably Pathfinder also... they put a lot of rules burden explicitly on the player. This is to some extent the culture more than the design of the game, but it is expected that you will know all the things your character can do and make decisions about when to do them. So many things times per day or whatever. And that puts... I have run GURPS games for people who have never played GURPS before, and basically have said, right, I'm not doing stuff with a lot of special powers. Here are your skills. They indicate what you're good at. The names are mostly pretty obvious. And here is how you roll against them. And that's more or less all you need to know to play a GURPS game. We've talked before, generating characters is much harder. But the D&D player often feels, A, there is all this stuff I had to learn to be able to play the game at all, even as a player, never mind as a GM. And B, well, obviously all of the games are going to be like that too. And I have met people who, when they get bored with D&D, go, just leave role-playing. Because their assumption is that other games are going to be like that too.
Yeah.
And so that is the specific reason I would not recommend a rules-heavy game as a first game, even one of the ones that I like.
Yes. I think that sort of person should be encouraged to go to conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And should be encouraged to try LARPing. Because that's as far as you can get from the tactical game and still be in the same wheelhouse. Or why do we say wheelhouse? That's a ridiculous metaphor. It's in my wheelhouse. Most of us don't have a wheel, let alone a house to keep it in.
It's at least in CIC, even if it's not on the bridge, yeah. I think the short version, which is completely unhelpful, is try to relax.
Yeah. Learning how much preparation is needed and then only doing that much is a huge part of learning to be a GM.
Not this is a thing that attracts obsessive and detail-oriented people or anything like that, looking at Roger in particular.
Come now. I think we all have a touch of the obsessed with details here about, probably even my cat. So
cats are natural GMs.
All cats are in charge. That's not the same thing. I was going to say, let us hope and pray that we've given some good advice amongst the blathering and move on. If you wish to tell us of the things you advised young, innocent minds to do, in the GMing field, or about the way you adapted a published setting to your obsessions and needs, you can contact us by...
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
And another month, we will try to be here for you again.